The Believer, Truth, and Truth. The ninth talk in a series titled Christianity and Truth was presented by Nancy Scott on November 20, 2001, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
The Believer, Truth, and Truth with a capital T. And we're going to look a little bit at the importance of non-ultimate truth or subjective versus objective kind of truth. And while I'm making those introductory remarks, the Study Center acting troupe, who you saw debut 2 weeks ago, is back tonight. And they could come ahead if you want to just like be in the background here for a minute. I think that actually I'll make more remarks after the short drama that we're going to watch. And then after they finish their performance, we'll talk a little bit about the subject matter. And then I'll talk a little bit about how we work with the subjective and with kind of the postmodern view of relative truth. So,
welcome back to Politically Incorrect. My name is Bill Maher, and tonight we're going to be talking about truth, something that doesn't come up much on the show. Now, our topic tonight centers on a book recently written by a Guatemalan lady, Rigoberta Menchú, who's with us here tonight. Now, this book exposes some atrocities committed by the Guatemalan army in the autumn of 1979. So before we begin tonight's discussion, let me give you some background information. In 1979, the Guatemalan army arrested, tortured, and executed 23 local guerrillas. Among the victims was one of Menchú's brothers, Cipriano Menchú, I believe. Now, could you please tell us a little bit about what happened?
Well, like you said, Bill, among those tortured was Menchú's 16-year-old brother. My family and I were alerted to this plight and hurried overnight to the southern Ecuadorio. We witnessed the soldiers soaking his body in gasoline and lighting him on fire to die in a few of the explosions.
Now, in response to this tragedy, you wrote a book, I, Rigoberta Menchú, correct?
I did.
Now, this book has practically made Menchú a celebrity, saint. Some even call her a world icon overnight. Now, in response to this book, Professor David Stoll, who is with us here tonight, also wrote a book in rebuttal to what Menchú wrote.
Yeah, I did write a book, and it's called Rigoberta Menchú and the Story of All Poor Guatemala. I only have two of the three volumes here. Hopefully you got the picture.
Well, this will be an interesting discussion. Tonight we have Professor David Stoll, Rigoberta Menchú, Professor Juanina Juanita, of Wellesley College, Hispanic cultural professor, Jay Leno, and David Letterman. So, thank you all for coming. Now, Professor Stoll, treatise that you wrote has made some shocking allegations against the truth and accuracy of Menchú's story.
Yes, it has.
Now, I understand the multiculturalism community and the human rights community are practically up in arms over what you've written. What, in your opinion, accounts for it?
Well, Bill, to be blunt, I believe that Menchú's story would be more appropriately classified as literature than a true expose on the need for peace. Because not only does Menchú advocate revolutionary violence in her book, which is rather odd for a book receiving the Peace Prize, but she also contains huge factual discrepancies and political distortions.
Now, with so many people claiming otherwise, on what truth do you base this book?
It's funny you should mention truth, Bill, especially since you rarely tell it. But the Guatemalan people are suffering and they are experiencing trials, and it's true that we should confront that. But the fact that Menchú's claims to eyewitness accounts, including the one about her brother, are anything but true has been confirmed by the New York Times, as I document in my book. In fact, no, her brother certainly was killed by the Guatemalan army, but not in that way, not in front of her, and in fact, no one has ever been burned alive in the Plaza in Peshawar.
That's complete. I watched my brother being tortured. I watched the soldiers pour the gasoline on his body. I watched them set him on fire, and I watched him writhe on the ground and die. I can't believe you would be so callous as to say that I'm not telling the truth. After all the pain that I've gone through, it's an offense to me that you would
say
that. She's completely right that many of her people have suffered in that way. But her brother simply was not among those people.
Your obsession with facts is just a cover for your racism.
What are you talking? I'm simply an anthropologist telling it as it is.
And who are you to tell it as it is? Were you there? Did you watch your brother being ripped apart piece by piece in front of your eyes? Did you see his flesh burn until it was charcoaled and black? Did you see your country fall apart at the seams? Who do you think you are to tell me what I saw?
Miss Menchu, I'm not telling you what you saw. I'm simply telling you the facts that I've discovered and the facts which the New York Times has confirmed.
You whites have been writing our history for over 500 years, and no white anthropologist, especially you, is going to tell me what
I experienced
in my own flesh.
I'm not telling you what you experienced. I'm simply telling you the truth.
But my truth is that my brother was burned alive.
Okay. Well, let's ask Professor Juanita what he thinks about this. Now, Professor, I understand that you believe that her book is true, but this is a farce. Is that correct?
No, it doesn't. The factual discrepancies of her book really don't bother me because though she's not communicating the whole truth, she's communicating a truth about the brutality of the Guatemalan military and U.S. financing of it. And that's the truth that needs to be told, and that's the truth that her book tells.
So the fact that she might have lied doesn't bother you?
No, because she's speaking about a larger truth for the whole Guatemalan people, not just.
And you don't find accuracy to be that important in this case?
No. First of all, I don't think that we should, as Westerners, hold the Guatemalan people to Western standards of journalistic accuracy. And also, it's just a given that all testimonies are tailored and exaggerated to individual experiences, and especially victims of trauma.
I couldn't agree with you more, Professor Juanita.
Why do you share her opinion with Philip?
Well, Bill, as I tell my wonderful autobiography.
Sir, excuse me, sir.
Yes, Mr. Letterman?
Can I look at the top 10 reasons why I hate Leno?
Maybe later. Let's let Mr.
As I was saying before.
Excuse me. Can I look at the top 10 reasons why his skin is liposuction?
No! Let him finish the story.
In my autobiography, meeting with
my
chin.
Excuse me. Hey, how come every time you stand on the scale, it says one at a time, please?
Okay, gentlemen, please. Let Mr. Leno finish the story.
I tell the following story about the time I appeared on the Dinah Shore show. The talent director beforehand talked to me about the importance of what we call in the movie. What this means is that when I give my final joke, I will give a little cue, in this case, thank you very much. And the bandleader will know to strike a little musical motif, I do a little step and step right off into the wing. Now, I got on the show. Dinah greeted me so warmly and the audience was so appreciative that I said unthinkingly, thank you very much. The audience panicked. The band leader panicked. They played my musical motif. What did I do but step off the stage? The most ridiculous plot of my career. But I made a great story.
I'm sorry to hear about that. Sorry. What did that have to do with anything we've been talking about?
Well, calm down, Bill. You see, the story didn't actually... Well, technically it did happen, but not to me. It happened to a friend of mine and a fellow comedian. But when I heard about the story, I thought it would make it perfect for a plot in my book, so I bought the story off and copyrighted it. Now it's my story, it's my truth.
So you lied in your book? For the sake of entertaining the public?
Leno, you have no morals.
You're a
fatso.
You're a four-eyed.
No, you got a big chin.
Well, truth does come up on this show.
That may seem funny, Bill, but what Leno said really hits home to what I'm trying to say. Menchu is simply trying to stretch the facts to make her story more powerful. But no matter how much suffering the Guatemalans go through, and they undeniably go through a lot, we simply cannot sacrifice truth on the altar is appealing to an audience.
Professor Stoll, my question to you is, what is true? If Manchu thinks your story is true, let her think that. And it is so inconsiderate of you to tell her that all the pain she's gone through and all the tears she's cried is a figment of her imagination.
And I...
You know what? I saw Robin Williams once cry in a movie.
Yeah, there is a resemblance.
And I, Professor Stoll, am simply appalled that you would be rude enough to think you can tell me what my truth is. My truth is that my brother was burned alive, and that's all there is to it.
No, that is not all there is to it. We have to look at the broader societal implications. No, it's breaking down.
Okay. Well, I'd love to continue this discussion, but I've got to go to the bathroom. So, thank you all for tuning in to Politically Incorrect. The question was, what is truth?
Did all the audience members survive? So what did you guys think?
I saw that episode.
Any comments, questions, thoughts? What's that? Yeah. Mm-hmm. They stayed on opposite ends, didn't they? What was most striking to you about story? First of all, just to outline the this is actual, I mean, this is a true story, as it were. Book that Rigoberta Menchu published was in 1983. It won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1992. David Stoll's book came out in 99, basically exposing that many of the facts reported as her autobiography in her book were not accurate, including the story about her brother, who she told this, it was kind of the climax of the book, apparently, that he was burned alive in front of she and her family. He was, in fact, killed by the Guatemalan army, but he was apparently shot, and it was not in front of them. So that was not factually accurate. And there were actually quite a few of those kinds of errors. And so David Stoll's book that he wrote cataloged those errors, and he interviewed like 120 people in Guatemala to corroborate her story. The New York Times then looked at it and did an independent report and corroborated his findings and published an article in, I think, winter of 98. To that effect, right before his book came out. So, that's the story. Deanna?
The most interesting thing was the fact that they would bring up the issue of that there could be different journalistic standards in countries. Mm-hmm. And using the terminology journalistic standards as a rationale for not publishing truth was an interesting concept of wanting to.
Yes.
Was that an issue that was realistic?
Well, yes. Actually, one of the there was a professor from Wellesley College, a Spanish professor who she was based on, and she took up Menchu's cause in saying that because she was proclaiming the larger truth, the factual accuracy wasn't really relevant, and that the issues of the oppression of the Guatemalan people, which is a very big issue and should be exposed. And Stoll is very interested in exposing that. So he was, his intention, right, his intention was not to undermine the cause of the Guatemalan people, but to maintain accuracy in reporting. So depending on which news sources you read, some very much support Stoll's work, others support Menchu and say that because of the cultural difference, she shouldn't be held to a very linear Western view of truth and facts being important. So,
similar thing happened with the Chariot of the Gods.
Really?
Yes, there was a lot of things that weren't quite factually true on that.
In the movie?
Well, in the book.
You mean in the book?
In the movie, Chariot of the Fire, who's talking about Chariots of the Gods?
I don't know what I'm thinking of.
The
one on the...
But Eric von Däniken.
Right, okay.
The Peruvians.
Yeah, the Peruvian mystical things that they found.
He just went to several parts of the world and had all these things, you know, proving that we were all planted here by aliens and those were gods. And then there was, I think there was another book that came out after that, Crash Show of the Chariots, where they started documenting all the problems with the first book.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there was a movie, and I think he was back on Discovery Channel here a couple of years ago again, still going at it.
Is that true of those cultures as opposed to, or is that just a thing to say?
I think that we definitely have different assumptions about time and like history being linear and those kinds of things, very possibly different conceptions. But a lot of the people who Stoll interviewed were Indians and Guatemalans who remembered what they saw and remembered it very differently than her, and their memories corroborated one another in exposing hers as being not accurate.
And you talked about her earlier today, we were talking about her background too, as far as boarding school.
Yes, one of her main contentions in her book was that she was an uneducated peasant, and it turned out that she was actually educated by nuns. She claimed that she didn't know Spanish until right before she wrote this book. And in fact, she had learned Spanish at the feet of the nuns in boarding schools before she was a teenager. She was singled out in her family as someone with great potential, and so the nuns took her in and gave her a good education. She didn't finish high school, but she was more educated than the rest of her family. Logan?
Do you remember when Bill Moyers interviewed Mortimer Adler on the issue of truth, and they had a group of six people representing six different cultures discussing the issue of truth? Had a man from Japan, a man from Africa, a man from America. I can't remember the others, but he presented the issue of a court trial. And it was amazing to me how the truth was not cross-culturally understood in the same way. From the same perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Especially around like issues of evidence.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the African was much more willing to accept a verbal description,
mm-hmm.
and the American wanted physical evidence, and the Japanese guy said neither one of that.
Mm-hmm.
I've never been exposed to that.
Interesting. Yeah. What was?
That's a question of what they consider reliable, not the question of truth, right? But he's talking about
mm-hmm.
what they consider reliable, not what truth is.
Mm-hmm. Possibly.
What truth is different, right?
Yeah. Yeah, questions of evidence versus what is truth. If the one culture takes different things as evidence, it might be a question of our skepticism that's come in to require certainty on a level that really isn't necessarily plausible in a lot of ways, and it's not really how we act in our lives. We don't need that kind of evidence to believe something in our regular lives. Other cultures might be much freer to take things like intuition as evidence or those kinds of things. What was the most alarming to you about the story? Can I get out from under the spotlight?
The reactions.
The reactions?
Mm-hmm. Are you seeing me?
Both of them? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All of them?
Dr. Stoll, he didn't seem blaming angry. The other two seemed more inappropriately
mm-hmm.
angry. They're just biting.
Mm-hmm.
Just alarming.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It seemed interesting that the professor from Wellesley, who was willing to admit the inaccuracies and yet overlooked them, that disturbed me less than the Roberto Manchu or whatever, who had either was just blatantly lying or had convinced herself that, you know, she had seen things she hadn't seen.
Mm-hmm.
But that seems to me more dangerous, because she's either trying to deceive or she's deceived herself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that was alarming to you, that she could be so convinced,
yeah,
or convincing anyway, in her energy toward saying what she saw was true.
One
for her.
One interesting thing about this attitude toward history is that the Greeks, the ancients, had a lot of the same attitude, that factual information wasn't as important as like the agenda of the author. So often they would overlook things. They wouldn't necessarily get eyewitnesses because that was important, mm-hmm, but they would write a history based on what they wanted to get across rather than on what happened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The politicization of writing started way back then. Uh-huh.
Do you know, in the introduction to Elizabeth's story, does she say anything discordant as fact?
No. It's autobiographical.
Yes,
yeah. And she wrote it with the help of a French woman who taped hours of interviews with her. And she was also interviewed and said that it was as she had told her story to her, and that Menchu actually had final approval of everything in the book. Menchu at one point, I think, said that it was the French lady who didn't get me right. But they actually went back over the tapes, and it was accurate from what Menchu had said. So...
Does Menchu admit now that it's not, or does she still stay to the truth, thinking that this is the truth?
She, the most recent thing I read said that she has not really entered the debate quite as much as this might indicate. Mm-hmm. She's stayed kind of laid low. But she does claim that her representation of the Guatemalan people and her Indian, the Quiche Indians, was the larger truth, and that is her position. So, and the Nobel Peace Prize panel has been asked to review the prize, and they have decided that they will not question it or rescind the prize over it, which is also very interesting. Deanna?
Thinking about fictionalizing a factual story is kind of something that starts really small, because any writer who wants to tell a good story about the truth can't tell, mm-hmm, everyone's they have to fictionalize to make it readable, mm-hmm, but how far does that go?
Yeah. I think that that's a really good point, and maybe that's a good segue into some of the stuff that I wanted to talk about tonight. Because I think that one of the issues that this raises is, how do we relate to our truth and the larger truth? And how are we as Christians to think about what's true subjectively to us and what's true outside of us? And how do we relate to rules of evidence, for example, or our understanding that is very much influenced by our own interpretation of events. Certainly this has huge political consequences, a story like this, where I think that the biggest danger in a situation like this is that when it's her story, and this is, I think, what John's pointing out, they went to fighting, and there wasn't really any discussion of facts going on here. It was offensive that they would question her because it was her story. And I think this is what's very alarming and disturbing about the postmodern frame that we're living in right now, is that we have our own truths, and so they're not open to scrutiny because it's my truth. How can you comment on my truth? And so with that frame, we don't really have any dialogue going on. It chills journalistic inquiry, and it stops the discussion. And on many college campuses, it's getting people fired or at least there's a guy at Portland State right now who's apparently fighting a lawsuit because he's arguing with the administration who actually cut his pay and demoted him, apparently. I'm not sure of the... I don't want to get the facts wrong, but he apparently said some things that were unpopular about feminist criticism, and this is what happened to him. There's also a story out of China where two scholars were dismissed from the... let me see if I have it here. From the state-run Chinese Academy of Social Sciences, after they published an essay calling for political and economic reform, they're prohibited from ever publishing again any of their views in government publications. Well, that's China, and we all, you know, we would tend to think, well, see, China's not a free country, so that's understandable because they're not free to say what they think. It's the same thing here right now. We are not free to say what we think. If it depends on political agenda rather than on factual accuracy, or when the debate goes personal, we know it's power based rather than truth based, and that's a really dangerous shift that we're seeing in our country, and one that I would encourage you to fight against.
You just made me think something. Isn't that one of the criticisms of what we would call the standard for truth, is that it's power-based? Like, that woman would say, whites have been writing our history for 500 years, so your history's accepted because you're the person in power, therefore you get to say what's true.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
very good point. Yeah, very good point. Which brings me to my second point. I think I would have staged this. No. I want to talk for a minute about how reality works, and then talk about the issue of how we relate our subjective experience to objective reality and how we work with that. Because certainly part of the postmodern movement is a backlash against the modern movement, which did what Logan is saying, and that is used power to enforce a particular agenda in the name of absolute truth. And so, similarly, that movement has kind of caused this backlash in this other movement. So there's got to be a different way of looking at this, rather than we have objective truth and this small group of people in power, the ones who decide what the objective truth is, and then impose it on the rest. I mean, that's been the model that we're used to, and that's the model that's being resisted, I think rightly so in a lot of ways, by the postmodern movement. Does that make sense? Okay. If we think about... last week I talked a little bit about truth and our pursuit of truth being something that shows us that God's Spirit is working in our hearts. Our posture toward truth, I think, is much more important and vital than are getting all the facts straight. And I think that that's an important thing. If we know with the limited information that we have as finite creatures, this absolute outside reality who is God, who is in a lot of ways not knowable to us. In many ways, he has revealed himself. So how do we bring those two things together? Rather than deciding that we know who that is and everything about that, and not being conscious of the ways in which we ourselves have an agenda. So, if you think about how reality works, we kind of go through life, we bump into things, we kind of have our things that we believe, and we take in a lot of information, we take in information emotionally and cognitively, and we take in information in school, and we take in information in our families that's more emotional, kind of, we learn the rules of our families that are very not necessarily conscious or verbalized, but are nevertheless very much learned. We learn our culture in those ways. We learn, we go to school and we learn science and math and English and all those things. So we learn on a lot of different levels. We learn with our minds, we learn with our emotions, and we learn with our experiences and all those things. So we go through life, and we kind of have this thing in place, our worldview, and we kind of go through life, and then we might hit a snag, and we get new information, or we have a different experience, or we have contradictory experience come in, and we hit a kind of a snag. There's resistance in how we can look at that. And what do we do then? Well, we have to shift a little bit. We have to shift our thinking or our understanding in a way that allows for the new information. So we adjust our worldview and our thinking. And we work toward whether, I think it's an unconscious process in a lot of ways, but we automatically, I think as humans, work toward a coherent and comprehensive picture of reality. And I think that that is no accident, because I think that we were created as knowers in that way, and that that is one of the imprints that we have of God on our humanness, that that we seek to know things in that way. We want to make sense out of things. No matter what we run into, we're always trying to make sense of it. And part of what happens is, if we get a lot of conflicting information and it doesn't make sense, we might have an allegiance to a particular view for some reason. We have new information that doesn't fit with that. It can be really crazy-making. Or it can also be crazy-making when I have information that, say, interpersonally, someone is telling me one thing, but then they treat me differently. Or they say they like me, but they're mean to me, or something like that. And I go, whoa, what was that? And that is kind of, it's like there's inconsistent information coming at me. And so I'm always trying to make sense of it. But I might also think, well, I should believe this part. And so I might push away my sense of feeling funny about that and say, yeah, but they say this, so I'm going to believe that. But I keep experiencing this. And so those things keep getting further and further apart. And I think our natural inclination is to try to get them to come together. And I think that that's a really good thing to try to do. But it's going to use a lot of different information. It's going to use not just the verbal information of what this person is telling me, but it's also going to use the information of my experience, so that I'm learning to trust what my intuition is telling me too, and help them to work together, so that we don't have to shove one or ignore one in order to elevate the other. So that's kind of how we learn and how reality works. So here we are in our subjective realities and in our experiences and our understandings, and we kind of swim in this soup that we call life, and how are we to know what's true outside of us? Well, I think that's where the Bible comes in. We have the Bible, and the Bible is a very special book. And I think that the way that the Bible is a special book is that it adds information from God's perspective to our soup. So we have our experiences and our interpretations of life and all that. Then we have the Bible to tell us what God's view of things is. So the way the Bible can be used and useful to us is not as owner's manual, the way that we were sometimes taught, and not as if we just do these things, then life will turn out a certain way, but rather it's God's perspective. It's God's view of things. And so as we come to understand what the authors intended when they first wrote what they wrote to their original audience, then that way we can reconstruct what God's perspective is. So we're building a biblical worldview in this way. And that's a lot of work, and that's a really good project to go with, to understand God's perspective. I think that that's the sense in which the Bible is inspired. That's the sense in which the Bible is authoritative. It's God's views written down through these authors, so that we can rebuild and understand how he looks at the stuff, how he understands the world, and how he and where his principles would. So that's the way the Bible can be helpful and useful to us in navigating this life. So we have our own experiences, and that's information. We have what we learn from the outside world, from the natural world. We have evidence in all these different areas that come in. And we filter them then through a set of lenses. And before we maybe have this biblical worldview in place, we're going to be kind of wondering where it all fits. But as we seek to build a biblical worldview through which to look at things, then we have a better chance of being able to interpret our experience in light of God's perspective. And that's what I'm claiming is objective reality. So God, as the author of all truth and reality, sees things a certain way. And we don't see things that way. We have the Bible to really help us get a picture of how he sees things and to give us principles through which to interpret what happens in our lives and through which to interpret the evidence here. Now that said, are there questions or thoughts about that before I go on? I'm going to have more time for discussion too, so not to worry. Okay. So what I want to get at there then is that we have all kinds of information. And I think that one thing that this question brings up, and Logan's point as well, is that we have this idea in our culture that that somehow or another we've gotten the idea that our subjectivity or our intuition is not as valid a way of knowing as the objective facts of evidence, or in our culture we place a much higher value on scientific inquiry and scientific ways of knowing than we do on what people might argue are more native ways of knowing, like Native American ways or third world cultures, which put a greater value on their intuitive ways of knowing. So I would like to just sort of say that I think it's open for question. I don't think one is more valuable than the other necessarily, but I think that we ought to bring them together somehow so that we understand the biggest part of the picture that's possible for us. And I see this in my work as a counselor often. I work with people who, like all of us, have come to believe certain things about the world. And they haven't learned those things with their mind, but they've learned them, as we all have, through our feelings. And yet we tend to drop how important our feelings are, and we tend to tell each other that our feelings don't matter, or that we shouldn't listen to our feelings, that we should listen to the facts or something. And what I try to help people do is to really understand the value of knowing what their feelings are telling them, so that they can take that as information and use it as indicator lights, like a dashboard, so that I can navigate my world. Because my feelings have taught me certain things. I've learned in the context of my feelings, I've learned in an early relationship or an early experience or something that didn't go through my head. And so I can change what I think about in my head, but it's not going to necessarily change how I respond out of my gut. So this might explain sometimes you, I know I've experienced this disconnect where I know I believe a certain way, but given a certain set of circumstances, that's not how I act. Anybody identify with that? I can argue all day long that I think that, that I know that God is in control, and that that people that I love don't necessarily die just because I love them. That would make sense, right? I know that. We know that. But I had an experience when I was really young that I didn't learn through my mind. My brother died when I was 2.5 years old, and somehow or another, that got interpreted in my world as, if you love people, they die. And so it's really scary to me to be in close, long-term relationships. And it took me a long time to understand how that worked into how I responded in relationships, because I didn't even know that's what I believed until I understood what that response was telling me on a deeper level. So it's that kind of way, I think, that our feelings can tell us something. It's not that our feelings are telling us something that's true necessarily, but our feelings are definitely telling us something that we believe. And there's a difference there. Once I listen to my feelings enough to know what it is I believe on that gut level, then I have a choice. Then I can decide whether or not it's true. And then I have choices about how I'm going to respond, even to my own gut feeling, when that comes up again. And that's a long, arduous process, and I recommend it to everyone. But it's hard work, and it's uncomfortable, and it requires knowing what painful feelings are telling us. So that's from my counseling model. I think that very much applies to how our intuition works and to how we navigate the world in ways other than just using our cognitive factual information. So I guess what I'm saying is that with a story like this, there's something to be said for Menchu's own truth, but it needs to be understood in the context of the larger truth, which is actually God's truth, rather than necessarily the larger truth of someone's political position or perspective. Because you could find five different people with five different interpretations about what happened in Guatemala. And then we have God's perspective on what happened. And I think that our goal should be to understand what God's perspective was on those events, as well as on the experiences of our lives. Does that make sense? So as we navigate the world, we look at the evidence, both within us and outside of us, and hold it up to the scrutiny of God's perspective and try to get his understanding on our experiences and the events going on. Does that make sense? Thoughts, questions? So, Chris? How we what? How we should what the facts?
Estimate
them?
We're trying to assume God's perspective. What part is our seeking to find out the factual information in the situation playing?
Now, I've completely blown it on the microphone, I just realized, for the earlier discussion, too. Would you like to, carry it around to people when they raise their hand? Okay. I think that as people who seek truth, we should be very concerned with facts. And I think facts are important. I don't think that facts are our enemy. And yet I also think that what Deanna was saying a minute ago is also true, that literature and fiction are very powerful tools for telling the truth. And there are a lot of ways that stories can be told that are true stories that may not be factual. One of my favorite singer-songwriters talks about that all the time. He writes songs, and this is Dave Carter, and he talks about how he is going to tell another true story. Well, he never means factual when he says that. He always means a story that's representative of the truth. And I think that there is that role for literature, but I think that the difficulty is when we stop being able to tell the difference. And that's, I think, where we're getting close to here. Or if we're not, I think we're already past it. We're already there, where we can no longer distinguish the difference. So not everything has to be an autobiography in order for it to be a powerful narrative. Does that make sense?
Yeah, sure. It's a question I've been asking myself for 5 years now.
So mm-hmm.
Your response is just another piece of the puzzle.
Yeah. I think that our commitment to truth definitely should take us toward being concerned about what's true, as opposed to being... Yeah. I mean, if we're going to distort facts for a larger purpose, I think there's a problem with that. I think that facts can serve the larger purpose of understanding true truth. And I don't think that facts will contradict that. Does that make sense? So it doesn't have to be our enemy, and I think it's something we ought to care about. Is that Logan?
So how did you unlearn your belief that if you love people, they die?
I don't know that I've unlearned it.
Do you believe it?
On a very primal level, in some ways, yes. But what's different now is that I understand that. And when the feelings come up that are telling me that, I know what they're telling me. And I can feel them and go through them rather than deciding that I better stay away from that person or whatever. Does that make sense?
No. If you are you're close to someone, you love them, and you sit down with them and say, hey, don't hang around me, you're going to die. And they say, what are you talking about? No, that's just the rules of the universe. If I love someone, they die.
Mm-hmm.
Now, for you to disabuse yourself of that belief, you're going to have to replace it with another belief, right? And what would you base the replacement belief on?
That's a good point. I think that I base it on new information that I end up risking when I decide that my belief is not telling me the truth. So, example, if I finally risk being close to people, then I get new information on that relational level. And I find out, oh, guess what? They haven't died yet. And they haven't. I have had that experience now. And it's been great. It's been amazing.
So do you let the facts overwhelm your belief?
Yeah, right. So I have new belief now, and I don't respond as hugely as I used to. But I still have a great deal of fear of grief and fear of loss. And I think that we all fear loss. I mean, I think grief is just as painful for all of us as it is for me. But I think for a long time I thought it was worse for me. And I think what it is I might be more afraid of it than some people are. I mean, for some of us it's like, well, it's natural and it's painful. Sure, it's painful. But it's not as paralyzing, perhaps. And that has also been something I've seen as I've lived through grieving more, that it has not undone me. And for a long time I thought it would. So I don't know if that's helpful, but it's like there are new beliefs in there. And I still respond out of the old ones sometimes. And I have to remember. Does that make sense?
I guess the bottom line is, do the facts hold more weight than your intuition, or your experience, or your emotions? When given the choice, the reason I'm having a lot of intuitive successes lately, it's kind of bothering me, but I'm just sitting there, when faced with a fact, which I weight as a fact, mm-hmm. then I'm faced with a choice if it disagrees with what I already believe or what I want. I can submit to the fact, or I can maintain my belief. I have to make a choice which one's more reliable, mm-hmm. and I have to make a choice which ones should be weighted more.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just wondering if you're going through the same process, if we're having the same experience.
Possibly, but I don't think it's cut and dried. I don't think it's formulaic. So it's not, I mean, you know, one day I might do really well at that, and one day I might not do very well at that. And I think that what my feelings give me a window into when I don't have a good day with that is that they remind me of what's hard about this life. And that's an opportunity that God, in that sense, is asking me to remember that and asking me to remember my vulnerability before Him and the pain of what happened in my family when that happened and all those things that are very real parts of my life that are still with me today. I don't think we forget. So even if we develop new beliefs, it's not that we forget. I don't think we're able to forget on that level. I don't think God intends for us to, because I think that all of the truth of our lives, part of the truth of our lives is very painful truth, but it's truth. And I think that God is a God of all of that truth in a way that gives us this fuller understanding of who he is and what his purposes are. Does that make sense? So I don't think it's an easy sort of, you know, not an easy answer.
Okay, something that's been kind of rattling around in my head for a while was the statistic of, well, for example, 80% of new businesses fail within 2 years. And I've seen two different paradigms of how people react to this. One would be their subjective truth would say, well, life's a numbers game. This is too big a risk. I won't go into business, even if they have all the appropriate capital. But then there's the other subjective truth that says, I'm capable of learning from other successes and failures, and it's okay for me to risk. And, okay, I'm doing this business type of thing, and I will only risk as much as I'm willing to lose, so therefore I can do this. So even in the face of the same, quote, statistic, the perceptions of what this statistic means can be immensely different.
Mm-hmm. That's what I'm trying to say. Yeah, that's a really good illustration, and it speaks to how we interpret things. It speaks to how our experience has taught us to respond. And there's a lot of, and in that sense, neither of those choices would be necessarily wrong. So I think that's an important piece, that it's not that there's one right way and one wrong way. There's all kinds of different ways to do things and to risk and to not risk. But understanding kind of how I'm seeing it and how that's affecting my decision, I think is a good thing.
I think another two was saying about you about
thinking
about what you were saying about you and then what was done up here in front of us. Seems like there's a big difference, too, that has to be taken into account, which you just hinted at, and that is interpretation. Your situation with death and grief, there are the facts of the death of certain people or the difficulties of certain people. And as you said earlier, God has his hand on that. He's got his perspective on what is taking place, and those are the facts. How we interpret them is where our whole subjective difficulties come in. We are interpreting the facts. We are not deciding the facts or
right.
You know, in this situation up here too, it's not even her interpreting the facts. The problem with this is she's telling people what the facts are.
Right.
Which are not true, which
right.
are not the facts.
Right.
She could have an interpretation on what took place, but you have to start with an interpretation of something. And she's starting with an interpretation of nothing. None of that stuff took place that way.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a real perspective
Absolutely.
Problem here.
And I think that speaks to Chris's question, too, that that the subjective part is the interpretive grid that we're seeing the facts through. And if we stop caring about the facts themselves, then we're really sliding.
Also, if we're using our interpretation as the facts, we're going to run into our own problems.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, we color them so much.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. I have no idea what time. Jonah.
I run into the problem every once in a while when talking to a friend, and the question frequently comes up, what are the facts? And I say, well, the facts are what happened. And he said, well, what happened? And then, you know, Bobby got hit by a car or Jimmy lied to Andrea or whatever. But, you know, how can you propose another way to get around maybe something a little less concrete than either your brother was burned in front of you or he wasn't? I mean, that's pretty concrete, and it's pretty hard to mess that up factually, but I guess it's possible. So
what was your example of what would be harder to tell the difference between?
What was my example? If we're talking about, like, for instance, when you said when you stop caring about the facts, that's when our grid, the subjective grid, is what the facts are. Mm-hmm. And so, if, for example, he's talking about going down somewhere to see someone for some reason, and we talk about, or actually we can get on religion, or I suppose, since we are here at the study center, talking about the differences in, say, Buddhism and Christianity, and how the Buddhists are more self related to God, and Christianity is more related towards Christ and whatnot. And he gets on this kick about, you don't know what the facts are with that person that's going through that, as opposed to someone who's here. And I said, I'm the facts of this religion is this, and the facts of this religion is this. And he said, well, you don't know that.
Mm-hmm. We say, here's an apple in my hand. Mm-hmm. Is there an apple in my hand or not? Well, I mean,
which goes back to Jack's first talk on the brief history of truth, when he talked about the nature of skepticism and how we don't hold many things to the same level that we're told we ought to hold them to, that it just really doesn't work that way. And we do have evidence to weigh in comparing belief systems. And what I would argue is that whichever one makes the best sense of the most information is the one that's most likely to be true. So there is a conversation that we can have about what evidence we're looking at. Now, that's without even the influence that we talked about last week of God's Spirit being who actually makes our hearts receptive to what's true. So apart from that, there's not going to be a following of truth in that way. So and with that perspective, with that grid in place, I'm going to find all kinds of evidence to cite for saying that that's not true, for saying that my pet belief, like last week I quoted Huxley, who talked about he wanted to be an agnostic, and so he came up with all kinds of reasons for finding that the universe had no meaning. But his commitment was prior to looking at the evidence, and he admitted that. And I think that that's something we each need to really take on, is how is our prior commitment influencing how we interpret the evidence, and whether or not we can even have that conversation. So, Christy? Oh, I'll bring you the microphone.
Well, I had an interesting experience yesterday, especially after the conference on... biblical truth and the cultural Christianity. I was on the train with Matthew, and in front of us was eight people that were coming to there was some vineyard thing in Albany yesterday. And this family went up to Portland to come back with the speaker that was going to speak in front of this vineyard gathering. And the speaker didn't make the train in Portland, and his kids with his mother, the language was just bizarre. And she was saying things like, Henry, just go pray in the Spirit. Just, calm yourself, pray in the Spirit. And just sharing, the adults were sharing the current experience of prophecies being fulfilled and intercessors. And it was very strange. And the little boy said something like, he's going to be he's on the train, Mom. I know he's on the train. We'll just go pray in the Spirit, Henry, and just, settle, calm yourself. And in Salem, the train pulled up in Salem, and here comes this speaker and his girlfriend.
And she said, oh, here they are. And they had driven down because they missed a train appointment and other thing. Well, the mother's interpretation to the speaker was, my son said you were going to miss the train, or you were going to be on the train in Salem. So she had taken a little boy, mom, he's on the train, he's going to be on the train in Salem. Well, the speaker tells his girlfriend when she comes by, honey, listen to what this little boy said. And this is kind of a more spiritual talk. This little boy said that I wasn't going to make the train in Portland, I was going to make the train in Salem, and he knew ahead of it. So this little boy's comment was made to say, are you following what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. I think so.
Just picture this speaker telling whoever he was speaking to, we have a prophesier in this. We have this little boy who's, you know, amazing. God has spoken to him. And he told, you know, he prophesied I was going to have to make a friend. You know, it was just bizarre. And I saw there's no truth. But it was fulfilling so much of what they were trying to conjure up within themselves through the whole conversation. It was just interesting because the truth didn't matter because it would make a great story.
Yeah.
But it was bizarre. But it was like you were saying about a little aspect of truth. This little boy said, Mommy's on, he's on the train. And it became, he prophesied that I missed the train and I would be on.
Anyway. He was wrong if they exposed
that. Or then the mother wouldn't have used that false confidence.
It's not the train, it's the ride.
You guys.
Trying to make itself fit God works in
Right. We'll get him and then.
Observed several problems with like truth in America. One thing, you know, we put a high value on, you know, scientific proof, but the problem that we developed, you know, scientific proof, there's certain procedures you go through, you know, you have several people working on the same thing, you know, blind studies, all that to prove something. But we have problems with scientists who don't, you know, they say they're scientists, but they ignore certain basic things, don't follow the rules. Like, I guess the, you know, best example is like evolution, where they ignore the second law of thermodynamics right off the back, and then they, you know, their proof is in the missing links, which are missing. And let's see, and then like on dating stuff, carbon dating. First of all, they, you know, assume, well, the Earth is billions of years old, therefore carbon-14 has reached equilibrium, therefore, you know, all of our measurements are accurate. Whereas if it's, say, 6,000 years old, then the carbon-14 hasn't reached equilibrium, and then you have to put in a skew factor for that. Mm-hmm. So we have, you know, it's, you know, you're right in thinking, you know, you should trust science, but the problem is you have to find out if you can trust the scientists doing the science.
Well, again, it speaks to the interpretation of the evidence rather than the evidence itself. And I think it could be easy to simplify that, but it fits into a bigger picture. So I think that there is, in the scientific community, there's a commitment that's prior to looking at the evidence, and that's what you're saying.
There's an agenda, and we have to prove the agenda, as opposed to.
But see, I don't think that that's a conscious process, and I think that we can simplify it too much and say they're purporting these lies. So I want to kind of step back from that and say that they, like Huxley, they have a commitment that's prior to their looking at the evidence that influences how they interpret the evidence. But I think that they're consistent in how they're doing that. So it makes sense in their framework. The framework is what needs to be questioned, not the how they're... I mean, does that make sense? It's like I can say, well, yeah, but we have this evidence about carbon-14 dating or this evidence about Well, yeah,
second law
you said.
Of thermal dynamics.
Yeah, second law and fossil record gaps. And we can point at all these things, but all we end up doing is throwing stones at one another unless we get up to the other level of where, at what point does our framework play into how we look at that same evidence? Because the creation scientist on one side of the room and the evolutionist on the other side of the room is looking at the same information coming up with totally different conclusions. And there's something to be said for that.
Well, the problem is
something else needs to be evaluated.
There is contradictory proof when it comes up. You know, it's pigeonholed, and the people who bring it up are no longer in the universities and stuff. So
right. Well, I'm not arguing that there's tremendous agendas at work out there, but I think there's also agendas on the creation science side, and I think that we're not getting very far with that debate if we don't get to this level of looking at the framework. Does that make sense?
Another thing is people in our government will redefine common terms to, you know, to get reelected or make the other political party look bad. For instance, the last example I remember was one party increased funding by 5% for all these programs, while the other party said, you should have increased to 10%, and then the next day all the headlines are, you know, this party has cut all funding 5%. You know, they've cut everything. Mm-hmm. Right? Whereas they, you know, none of us would say that was a cut. You know, an increase is not a cut, but they redefine the terms.
Mm-hmm.
And then the final point.
And then what?
Then the final thing
I
observed is, for instance, like the fact, you know, reporting facts and stuff, eyewitness accounts and things, this goes to like biblical accounts. Or to use an analogy here, say, Logan came to a Bible study where there was a bunch of black chairs. He came at night to a Bible study where there was a bunch of black chairs here. I came to a program where they had several people speaking. You know, there was four brown chairs there. It was early evening. And I came with, and I was here with Logan. Well, then, some people say, well, then, that event couldn't have happened because the accounts are so different. Whereas mm-hmm. everything I said was true, I was just noting different facts.
Mm-hmm. Right, which is certainly how looking at the, I'm going to be Oprah here. Come over here. just the idea that that the Gospels, certainly the Gospel accounts are have those kinds of features to them, that understanding the author's intent and what the author's purpose in writing his account was is very important in understanding. And a lot of people will look at the discrepancies in those Gospel accounts and claim what you're talking about, rather than saying there was a different goal that this author was...
I just wanted to comment how interesting it is in the New Testament how the term witness, where it talks about witnesses to resurrection and the crucifixion, how it really values the framework like you were talking about. There's no sense of you ever read where people say, this is the facts, this is the facts. You always hear them saying, I don't know, this is what I saw, or this is what I heard. You know, I don't know, I was just there, this is what I saw. And it's a real kind of, it's a humble, and yet it allows for that to ring off from one person to another, and then to say, okay, I'm going to put that into my framework. Mm-hmm. Like you were saying, rather than, mm-hmm. here's your framework, it's crystallized, let me hand it to you on a platter.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of,
there's
an unspoken value.
There's a humanness there.
Yeah.
In those accounts with that. I think, though, that it is important to note, though, that I think the apostles, the disciples who then became the apostles, were certainly given a different kind of responsibility in spreading the gospel because of their eyewitness observance of Jesus and his ministry. And they were the authorities because of that evidence, firsthand evidence that they had. So I think that there is a valuing of evidence in that sense. And yet I think what you're saying is that there's also a human element to that, where, like Wes last week was talking about the guy who Jesus healed, who had been born blind, and the Pharisees, from their perspective, kept trying to say, well, was it your parents that sinned? Was it, you know what, tossing all these other explanations out there, and the guy was just kind of going, look, all I know is I was blind, now I see. And you guys are working way too hard to make this something that it isn't. Maybe this guy really is who he says he is. So, yeah, thanks.
I just was wondering, I was thinking about even the thing 2 weeks ago, the little skit 2 weeks ago, and these parents who, you know, their child was, they already had one child commit suicide, they had another child who was facing that, and they were unwilling to see reality as it was. So how do you communicate with someone whose framework is either so muddled or so, they're so unaware? How do you,
so
you're talking
committed.
About instead of being
it's
able
different.
To throwing stone, right, instead of throwing stones at one another, how do you address someone within that framework? How do you reach that framework with someone who is so living in such untruth?
I don't know that we always can. I mean, I think we evaluate the openness and the readiness of people and throw seeds out when we have opportunities. But I don't know that, like those parents, that doesn't look good for them to see it. I mean, you say what's true. I think you still say what's true and challenge it. But I think you also take into consideration the evidence that you already have that they probably won't hear it. I mean, I don't know how appropriate it is to keep forcing the issue. Does that make sense?
So what about you?
I don't know exactly what Jesus meant when he was talking about pearls before swine, but it could be in the end. I mean, seriously, that we give up.
So when you talk about even addressing that framework with someone who is willing to look at it, mm-hmm. are you talking about just talking about what people's presuppositions are?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So that the questions are at least at that level, rather than at the interpretive, what's already been interpreted level.
So kind of the prerequisite for that is that both people have to be
willing to go to that level. Yeah.
Would you return to the distinction you were making between truth with a little t and truth with a big T? And specifically, in the instance of a truth with a big T, is it ever known by the intuitive processes that you were describing? Or are truths with a big T known only objectively?
My distinction with the big T and the little t would be that the truth with a big T is God's truth, God's perspective.
And did you assert that we can see? Did you assert that we can see reality with God's perspective?
I think we can,
something we can do
to a large degree. I don't think completely, no, because I don't think I think our finiteness limits us in how much we can understand of God's perspective. But I think that there is a lot that he has revealed about who he is and what his deal is, what he's doing in history.
Okay, that's truth with a big T.
Right.
And truth with a little t?
Truth with a little t, I would say, is our experience and our understanding of the truth. It's all true. I think that truth with a small t reflects the larger truth. If we compare it, if we hold it up to scrutiny, to God's perspective, I think there's a lot we know intuitively. That's truth with a capital T. And so our truth, in that sense, can reflect God's ultimate truth. But I think that the danger is that we need to always be aware and understand that our perspective is going to be limited and also jaded by our sinfulness. So that's where I think we need to be really cautious and also open with each other to help. I think that's what we need each other for, is to help us see better. Because left to ourselves, we don't see ourselves well. Kind of like what Larry was talking about 2 weeks ago. Does that answer your question?
There are more.
Okay.
So, piggyback.
Okay. You're next.
Okay, well, we're talking about truth and facts, right? Okay, and we're applying it to human writings, right? Okay. So how do we apply that to biblical writings? I mean, I assume that the Bible is inspired and that it's not, that it's different than any other book, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
But you were talking about this singer-songwriter that you like that mm-hmm. says, I'm going to sing another true song. Well, it's not factual. So
right. How
do you apply that to the Bible? I mean, do you...
Oh, okay.
Do you know what I'm saying?
Well, I think maybe it's with Tim's example of, if two different people are telling the same story, it could have different facts in it. I don't know that they're not true, but they're from different perspectives. So they could sound like they were different things happening. And I think that that's what you look at in the biblical text, is you want to look at the author's intention and understand in the context of kind of what the goal of their particular writing was to understand it.
So let's go the other way and say, how would you confront a person who says, well, the Bible is just a book of fables, basically?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in that case, the stuff in there is true, but it's not necessarily factual.
Well, I think that that's a really interesting question, because some of the new, like Joseph Campbell's whole thing on mythology, and it's like, anymore, we consider myths to be true. And it's kind of an odd, interesting thing, I think. I would probably engage them on how they're looking at where they're questioning the Bible in terms of historical accuracy or whatever. I'm not an expert on that. I would send them to somebody probably, but but Gabe, this is the last question. We're about out of time.
Is God a
I don't know what that means. What does that mean?
We're talking about nature, big truth, we're talking about facts, mm-hmm. we're talking about search for truth. And so it's a question in the sense that we're pursuing God, we're pursuing the truth, you know, what are we pursuing?
Mm-hmm.
How often do we need to approach this thing? And so should we think of God as bad?
I think that's kind of odd.
What
so
do you think of that?
I don't know. I don't know what you mean, really. But God is the author of all the facts. So in that sense, he's beyond the facts. And he's beyond fact. He's outside of this reality in that way. So that's part of why I'm saying I don't think that makes sense so much. But certainly the existence of God is a fact.
But, you know, in our pursuit of big capital E, group,
mm-hmm.
which is essentially God's perspective, so we're essentially
mm-hmm.
pursuing God's perspective.
Mm-hmm.
God is the creator of the universe. Is he interested in facts?
I would think so.
In the scientific sense, of measurement. In other words, I mean, the whole concept of fact, the word of fact, it seems to me it comes out of the modern development in the history of thought, namely science. So does God approve of the Western rational separation, you know, and deliberate conscious effort to kind of measure? You know, is that the way... In other words, is that the way that he wants us to pursue?
I don't know that there's... I don't think he would disapprove of it. I think it's part of his created reality that facts work the way that they do and that we've made the technological advances that we have because matter, elements, all those things work in a certain way because of how he created it. Is that the way to arrive at who he is? It's part of the way because there's evidence. And he, I mean, whether or not there's, I don't think our level of, I mean, this, where the skeptics came in and said our level of certainty has to be up here, I don't think that's necessary for anyone. I mean, I don't think that's how we live. So I think that's pretty extreme. But anyway, is that kind of
a problem, you know, it's a question. Mm-hmm.
I don't think they need to be in tension, I guess, is my other thought, that the facts and our intuition, if we are heading toward the same ultimate truth, we're going to get there on either route. And so they don't have to be at odds with each other. Does that make sense? And I think in our culture we have made them at odds, unfortunately. So all truth is God's truth in that regard. I mean, if we're really looking at something that's true, it's God's truth. And we can go at it that way. I don't think we have to be afraid of following the truth wherever it takes us. We used to have a joke about, or a saying around here, where is God the kind of God who would want me to believe in him even if he didn't exist? And that speaks a little bit to your statement about is God a fact or whatever, maybe. But, you know, you can picture getting up to the heaven's door and finding a note on the door. I don't really exist, but keep believing in me anyway. I don't think so. You know? So, anyway, thank you for your attention. And thanks for playing.